Hey friends, how are you?
Doing well. How are you, Shane?
Good, good. Good to see you, Dorothy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's see here. We've got Chris, you're there. I see you. Just letting everybody in. Apologies for a little delay here. Was having a hard time logging in for some reason. Glad to see you all. And I think we're the speed. Okay, I think we have most. There's going to be more that'll join a little later, apparently. All right, so today we have Mark's otter.ai. I wonder who that is. Who's Mark? That's interesting. Anyway, glad he can join. I'm glad his AI can join. Okay, so we have... today, as you know, I usually do a little bit of training and then we open it up for questions and comments. So today we're going to begin. I'm going to introduce you to some elements that you find in the module two, how to have hard conversations training. This is going to be, we're not going to be actually getting into the hard conversations. We're going to be doing like the pre-groundwork that sort of gets at a little bit the way that I think about the coaching work that I do when I'm working with people. And it's really designed to help you all start to also think like coaches, because in many ways, as a leader and a manager, you are also supposed to be a coach. So this is some of that stuff. And a lot of it is going to be connected to communication. So let's get started here. I'll share my screen. All right. So some of this is going to be a little bit of review. Many of you probably know some of these things, but for those that don't, I need to do just a little bit of review. And that is that one of the operating principles that I kind of use when I'm working in organizations or working with leaders or anything is this awareness that emotion is the hidden power that shapes almost everything in teams and organizations. And so I estimate roughly 80% of decisions and behavior in a team are governed by this thing that I call the emotional system. And so you've seen the iceberg metaphor before. There's the stuff you can see above the surface, and then the emotional system lives beneath the surface. And it's really defined simply as how I feel about the work I'm doing and how I feel about the people I work with and for. So... you personally, individually, you have your own autonomous emotional system. You have feelings about the work you're doing. You have feelings about the people you work with and for. And some days you love the work you do, and some days you hate the work you do, and some days you love the people you work with, some days you don't. And all of them have their own sets of feelings around the work they're doing and the people they work with and for. And so what ends up happening is you have a very complex emotional system, because there's lots of different things and feelings that are highly dynamic. And so when it comes to having hard conversations, a big part of what I'm doing is navigating this emotional system. You know, the words that we use are incredibly formative, and they impact this emotional system in a pretty big way. And so hard conversations are really about having the right conversation with the right person in the right way at the right time. And you become a lot more effective in a hard conversation when you have a high level of self-awareness, when you begin to become increasingly aware of your tendencies, your patterns, your habits, you get better at having those conversations. And that'll become clear next week when we actually run through the training on how to have hard conversations. But for today's purposes, one of the things that I like to play with is this idea of getting in touch with reality. So if you were on the Enneagram training, you maybe remember we talked about trillions of bits of data coming at us every second, and the human brain can only process 90 bits per second. And so we use both human senses, which block out a lot of information. We use perceptual filters, which distort some of that information. And so we end up living in this state of thinking that what we see is real. And while it's maybe an aspect of reality, it doesn't capture all of reality. And the good news about not being able to see all of reality is that if you begin to shift your focus of attention, you can effectively create new realities. You can begin to access things that exist that otherwise wouldn't. And so that's a big part of the work of coaching. A big part of what you do when you lead and manage other people is you are trying to help them get in touch with reality and more realities that are more resourceful, right? So sometimes a reality can feel very limiting to all of us. And that creates and produces a set of emotions, which then impacts decision-making and choices. And so when you can go back and think about different frames and different ways of thinking, you start to become a lot more effective. Okay, so to start though, I want to talk about the basics of self-awareness, which are this. There are things that we can see, and then there are things that others can see about us. So this is now looking at yourself in the mirror. This is called Johari's window. If you've ever seen it, this will be familiar. But the things you can see and the things others can see, that's called your public face. That's the stuff that you know, and they know you know. That's our public face. You all know I'm a white male who's devastatingly handsome and not so bright. That we all know that I know that, and you know that. And so it's really great. I don't have a nearly as great a mustache as Chris does, but I still look great as far as I'm concerned. Okay, so I don't know how I got sidetracked by your mustache again, Chris, but it was great. okay, so then we have this other thing that others can't see, but we can still see. So that's our inner life. Our inner life is governed by things that I choose not to make public for everybody. So maybe I'm not feeling well today and I didn't sleep well last night and I don't really want to be here. And Chris's mustache is making me feel envious, not more jealous than it is. Like I feel good. Now I'm feeling worse about myself, but I don't have to reveal any of that to any of you. That's my inner life, my private life. And I think your mustache is going to feature large in this training, Chris, I'm afraid. okay. What we can't see, but others can see, is our blind spots, but also our gifts. So there could be hidden talents, but also hidden blind spots. So, you know, I remember a blind spot of mine that I really vexed me for a long time, and I couldn't understand what was going on, is people would often tell me that I was either intimidating or that I came off as arrogant. And I was really, really hurt by that, because I was like, I don't feel arrogant. I don't know why that's happening. I don't think I'm better than people. I'm really interested in listening, but for some reason, I couldn't see this part of me that others could see. And along the way, one of my mentors came to me and he helped me one day when he also observed it about me. And he just said, Shane, he knew me super well. He knew me from when I was a kid. So he kind of knew how I grew up. And I grew up with dyslexia, and I was very, very insecure about my intellect because my parents and my brother were super smart. And I was like, had an eighth grade reading level in my senior year of high school. And I was always in the remedial reading groups. And I got a 720 on my SATs, which you get 400 for signing your name. So it was literally like it predicted I would get a D average. So I just felt not smart. And over the years, I had to eventually that filled in and I did well in college and things worked out. But I think I still carried a chip on my shoulder. And he said that to me once. He said, Shane, you don't have to prove how smart you are. If you just accept that you're smart, you won't come off as quite so arrogant. And it was really, really revealing to me. And so I spent quite a bit of time reflecting on that. Another time was a gift that I didn't know that I had. It was actually, I went to seminary where they trained pastors. And I remember I took my first homiletics class, which is a fancy word for how to preach. And I had never preached before. I didn't really know anything about it. I found it fairly stressful to even imagine standing in front of people trying to think of a sermon and something useful and profound to say. And I did my first sermon, and the professor took me aside and he said, Shane, you have a real natural gift for preaching. And I was just shocked. I had no idea that this guy who was an expert thought I was really good at it. And so that was a gift that I began to cultivate and nurture that I just didn't see. So as you reflect in your own life, you obviously have blind spots and you have blind gifts. So, and then the last area is really what we call, some reason. Oh yeah. Have you ever had someone point out a flaw you didn't know you had? Have you ever pointed out an ability or pointed out an ability you didn't see in yourself? So those are the things that we're seeing. Okay. And then the last group is the hidden life. The hidden life is something we don't see and nobody else does either. So that means right now there's a vast amount of stuff in our unconscious that is full of kinds of hidden motivations, hidden limitations, hidden profound resources. It is very likely that I am an unbelievably talented curling player, but I've just never tried it. So I don't know. So none of us know how great I could have been if I had taken up curling, right? So the point is that there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for people. There's a hidden life that even if someone doesn't believe they're good at something, if you give them a chance, sometimes they could be, right? So there you go. That's Johari's window is what it's called. And a huge part of the work of coaching and development and self-development is, is moving everything from the I can't see column to the I can see column. The more you can see of yourself, the more mobility, flexibility, adaptability you'll have, the more capacity you'll have to know how to navigate complex situations, the more of reality you get access to. And so you have more choices. So the Enneagram is one of the great tools that gives us access to both our hidden life as well as our hidden gifts and hidden limits. So that's why I love that tool so much. And that's a big part of what we're doing. Okay, so comments or questions about any of this, I know it's fairly self-evident, but sometimes it's just helpful to know what journey you're on. And a big part of this program is designed to increasingly bring more of your awareness to things. And when we get into next week, hard conversations, you know, human conversations are incredibly high risk. There are all kinds of ways one wrong word in the wrong place can completely trigger a whole cascade of dominoes that you didn't intend to fall. And one of the most powerful ways to navigate hard conversations is when you bring a really high level of awareness of what's going on in you to that conversation. Whether you reveal it all or not isn't the point. It's that you are aware of what it is that's happening, and it allows you to become much more deft in the way you manage those high stakes conversations. Okay, comments or questions here? All righty, great.
I have one question. Yeah. Hi, everyone. Hi, Shane. Thank you. Hi. This is already so fabulous. So when you're bringing it into awareness, like, for example, I was just on a call where someone pointed out a gift of mine that I'm slightly aware of, but when we can see it, is there that there's obviously more levels of now I accept it about myself or embrace it. We're just talking about just being aware, right?
Yes, correct. It's just awareness. So in my example, when I learned that I was, that I had a gift for preaching, according to this guy, it didn't make me excited. It made me scared. Right. I was like, oh gosh, I don't think I want to do this. And then I tried to do another one, and I was super nervous when I tried to do my second one in that class, because I'm like, well, maybe I just had like a one-hit wonder, and I was right. Just really good in the moment. And then I, you know, I'm even more stressed for the second one. And then I do it, and he's like, yeah, you should be part of this preaching award. I'm like, oh, an award? Now I'm all up in my head. And no, so it wasn't great, right? And then when I became a preacher, and I got genuine positive feedback that yes, this is a valid, legitimate thing you're good at. I never fully loved it. Like, it was always a mantle rather than a passion. And so when I left the church, people always ask me, like, do you miss preaching? I'm like, not at all. I don't miss it. That's a very stressful thing. I know other people who, when they preach, they're like, I feel like something's burning inside me. I have to get it out. And I love it. It's my passion. And it's all I want to do. And I'm like, oh my gosh, wish I had that passion. Like, I seem to have the ability, but the passion didn't match it. And so, and I did that for like 8 years, and I still never got to the point of like, I just love this. So I don't know if that helps.
No, totally helps. I think it brings a level of maybe more ease, not trying to be in love with all of our gifts.
Exactly. Yep. So a big part of, there's another, I don't do it in this program, but one of the books I wrote is called Cats Don't Bark. a guide to knowing who you are, accepting who you're not, and living your unique purpose. And a lot of the exercises are in there are connected with not only what is it that I'm good at, but what is it that gives me life? Mm-hmm. And these two things together have to coexist, because I've had plenty of people like that absolutely hate a job they're amazing at. Yeah. And so it is important to notice, like, your sense of desire is a powerful form of guidance in that moment, right? And it's dynamic. So it could be that right now you don't like it, and there may be some blocks in you that if you cleared some of those, you would love it. And it's also possible that it's just not a thing you like, and that's okay. So it's well worth kind of paying attention to how you feel and asking the question, what is it that's contributing to that feeling? So a big part of what was contributing to my lack of love of preaching was actually my shadow. That if, as I cleared more of my shadow, I learned to really enjoy it more. And it never became like the thing I have to do, but I definitely, a big part of my, because I'm a 3 on the Enneagram, you know, when you're standing in front of 6,000 people, that's 6,000 opinions, maybe 8,000 opinions, you know? And so if your shadow is constantly trying to adapt to what people want from you, it becomes quite crippling. You just end up being like, well, I can't really be everything to everybody. And it's very annoying. And so I had to constantly be clearing that shadow for me to get up and feel the purity of that gift and really express it. And then detach myself of the outcomes. Because there'd be Sundays people come up and be like, well, that was amazing. That was such a great sermon. And I'd be like, yeah, okay, well, did it change your life, or was it good, or wasn't, you know, and somebody didn't like it. And I had to like learn to detach from all of it and just offer it without any expectation. Mm-hmm. And then I could really enjoy the gift again. So there we go. That's I'm just saying that the love and the desire is a big part of guiding you. But if you don't love it, pay attention to the potential blocks that are there.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And we can process yours specifically if you want. Yeah, Chris.
Just a quick note and question. 2 weeks ago, I couldn't get on last week. I was so bummed to miss it. But 2 weeks ago, I love that point you made about not typing people. That's been in my mind like ever since. Because we even met with a friend this past weekend, and she was, you know, saying how she thinks she's an 8. I was like, oh my gosh, you're totally a 4. You're so a 4. Like, but it just cannot say it. And I'm like, am I going to say it? And then thinking about how you're kind of leading us here, this conversation about having tough conversations with people. I mean, I this is a great setup for it. I'm really seeing, because it's like, yes. Okay, we can see something, try to help someone, and like, oh my gosh, you can't see this, but this is so evident. Like, oh my Lord, because you don't want to type them. So it's just like, how do you, you know, bring them there and lead them there. So yeah, I just wanted to say thanks again for that little nugget.
Absolutely. And by the way, when you're, you know, in your role, when I say don't ever type anybody, what I really mean is, you know, if you're in a role of a coach and people are coming to you with wanting input and guidance, it is actually appropriate to say, hey, you know, it'd be really worth you spending time reading more about the 4, because you might find resonance there that would surprise you.
Okay.
And that's a way to get somebody to get their locked on, like, I'm an eight. And you're like, you're so not an 8. You know, but just to be clear, like, the journey of the Enneagram is really fun and interesting. And the goal is for that person to find that discovery on their own. And you provide a little guidance. One of my clients that I worked with for 4 years, he was convinced he was a 3. I knew he was an 8. And I would just gently, periodically kind of plant the idea. And then we'd do things for a while and plant an idea. And then, you know, it's possible. It's really interesting you say that. Every 8 I know really relates to this. Do you relate to that? Like, totally. Interesting. I wonder if you're not an 8 instead of a 3. Anyway, we're going to keep moving. And then this year, he was like, oh my gosh, I reread it. I was like, I'm totally an 8. Everything's an 8. I'm like, interesting. Yeah, that's great. That's great self-awareness. He's like, you were saying it all along. And I'm like, well, it's your discovery, not mine. But yeah, that's part of it. So that is... As a coach, that is part of the work, is to help surface the hidden life and surface the blind spots and allow people to come to terms with them.
Cool.
Great stuff. Good comments. all right. So let's keep moving here. And Bridget, I'm more than happy to engage specifically in yours if that would be useful to you.
I think there's such a block around it that it is actually kind of hard to explain, but someone was saying just on a call, like, you're so magnetic. You're so like, people are just attracted to you. And you like light up a room, and that feels, there's blocks, so many blocks there of, well, I let people down. I have fear of if that's true. Fear of success and fear of letting someone down, because if I attract them, then I have to hold their attention, or I don't know. There's a lot there that honestly, I haven't worked through a bunch.
You're a seven. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you literally use the exact words that I use to describe sevens when I'm trying to teach the Enneagram. Yeah, literally.
Oh my God. Like,
they light up a room, they walk in, everybody, all the boats rise, everybody's just happy to be there. And one of the at the heart of being a seven is a really interesting dynamic, which is they have both simultaneously a love of being the butterfly, but they're always afraid of becoming a kite. And what that means is, metaphorically, I don't want you to attach your strings to me. Like, I just want to be the magical creature, but I'm going to bring my magic when I feel like it, where I feel like it, without you guiding or deciding that we need your magic now. I will bring the magic because I'm a butterfly, not a kite. You don't fly me. You don't attach a string to me. You don't hold on to me. I'm free. And that's the fundamental thing that a seven craves, is that freedom. So they're always trying to cut the strings to be like, no, don't, but I don't, no, you don't get to take that. I will be. And so it's worth you just reflecting a little bit on that and asking, you know, how much does that resonate for you? That sense of like, I don't want that expectation. I'm fine being that, but I don't want you to tell me that that's why I got to be.
Wow. That resonates so much. Like the cutting of the, like, just, oh, like, and the part of bring it when I feel like it, which sometimes feels like, why can't I bring it all the time? If I'm a seven, why can't I be happy, cheery all the time?
Yep. That's right. One of my favorite things about sevens is that they reframe everything to the positive, even when it's not positive. And one of the guys that I used to preach with, he's a seven to the extreme, and he's just incredibly gifted on a stage. And every time, like, he had some really bad things happen to him. People did nasty things to him, betrayed him. And the closest he could get to an honest comment about that was, oh yeah, it was really interesting. So whenever he says, it was really interesting, like, he literally was invited to be on Oprah Winfrey's network and had a show that lasted 3 days and was canceled. And he was like, yeah, it was really interesting that it got canceled. And I'm like, yeah, translation, devastating.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not an emotion that a seven likes to allow themselves to walk into. And so it's a way that they protect, because the other fundamental thing that a seven is running from is just pain. Like, they just don't like pain of any kind. Negative, hard, difficult emotions, I can do without. And so they tend to bounce and flee from that. So a big part of the growth of the seven is not to kind of like, oh, you need to force yourself into the fire and sit down in the pain and swallow hard. It's not that. It is, do you notice, just awareness, don't even change it. When you bounce, when you shift, when you escape, do you notice what you're escaping from? Mm. Continue your escape. Don't feel you got to sit with it. Part of the power in the Enneagram is just awareness. Awareness brings transformation without any effort. And so if you become conscious and awake and aware to the thing, the shadow monster that you're running from, that shadow begins to diminish. But as long as you keep it unaware, it guides and governs you. It dictates your choices rather than you dictating them.
I love that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So just check in with your call.
And I'm like, mind's blown in the last 28 minutes, Shane. So
happy to be helpful. I'm so glad you're here with us. Thanks, Bridget.
Thank you.
Okay. So what we'll do is I'll continue a little more teaching, and then we'll just open it up and we can talk about anything. It can be the Enneagram, it can be anything else you want to talk about, anything you're struggling in your business with your people, anything at all. Okay, so just a few other things. So that's the that. Let me make sure. Okay, now I want to just talk about conversational styles. This is a way that you are kind of show up in the world. This is your natural tendencies for how you communicate. And I use two different models. They're similar, but a little bit different. And like models are useful as long as you don't take them too seriously, right? As long as you don't believe anything, then it's useful. You don't want to create dogma out of this. But there's a famous researcher named Karen Horney, who's a psychologist, who observes that there is three primary ways that human beings relate to each other. And I like the model a lot. The first way is to be against. And when you're against, against is, you know, there's both a healthy and an unhealthy expression of being against. There's the caustic, hostile physical violence or verbal violence. And then there's healthy boundary setting and protecting others and pushing against, right? So that's the healthy. And then you've got moving towards. And there's a healthy moving towards, which is expressions of need, vulnerability, care and concern, compassion, nurture. Unhealthy moving towards is when you become needy or manipulative or ingratiating. And you do these subtle ways of kind of becoming the tyranny of the oppressed. And so that's that unhealthy movement towards where you're kind of making that subtle sucking sound of energy. And then there's moving away. There's healthy and an unhealthy moving away. So you're either have the ability to say, hey, you know what? Conversation's getting heated. I'm not really clear myself. I'm noticing that I'm getting more activated. I'm going to take a break from the conversation. I need to step away for a little bit, but I will re-engage. And then unhealthy moving away is I just never make contact. I stay nice 40 feet away at all times, or I get so emotionally flooded, I merely cut off and then I vanish. And I make no effort to come back to readdress the issue. I just use it as a technique to escape. And that's my natural MO. And so the basic theory is that so you can see there's like the pure away towards and against, and then there's blended versions, right? So we tend to be really, really good at two of these and really, really unskilled at one of them. Sometimes we're only good at one of them. That does exist, but most of the time there, I do know some people that are really one dominant note in most areas of their life, but for the most part, most people are pretty natural at two of these. So my two, I was green most of my life. I really was green. I did not validate moving against in any way. I didn't like it. I didn't understand it. And so on the Enneagram terms, by the way, this maps perfectly on the Enneagram. I did this a few weeks ago. There are the compliant away types, compliant types, and assertive types. So as a reminder, the away types are 9, 5, and 4. So they form a little triangle kind of at the top. The assertive types are 8, 7, and 3. They have a little triangle of their own. And then the remaining, we call them compliant types, but it's really that moving towards. It's the agreement. That's the 1, the 2, and the 6. They tend to want to create things that are more together. So that's the tendency of each type. And what would happen is because I was a 3 and my 9 connection was super active, that was that towards and away. That's where I lived. And I really had a hard time activating that against energy. And I had to learn that when I was a pastor. Which was really interesting because as a pastor, nobody wants you to be against. They really expect you to be very much towards at all times. Like if you move away, you've abandoned me. If you move against me, you're mean. You just need to be kind, nurturing, and sweet at all times. Just be that, and then I'll be happy. And so weirdly, the profession I chose compounded my pathology. And I had to work really, really hard to overcome that part of me to learn how to step away and create space and then set boundaries and tell people when they needed to step back and all that fun stuff. So what do you notice about yourselves? Take a moment and just reflect and maybe just share out, where do you think you guys live on this continuum?
I'm like a little bit lost because this is the first time I'm hearing this. And I was like trying to write down all these numbers you threw at us, I was like, hold on, like I kind of got lost in the whole conversation. So I don't know who I am or where I'll be, but I'll listen to the recording and figure that shit out. So
I'm more than happy to share again if you're if it's unclear. I can give a, I can do it simply.
I feel so special. Thank you.
Towards is a movement in relationship that is warmth, nurturing, caring, connected. Away is the movement in relationship to become objective or have space. And assertive is the movement in the relationship to move against and confront. And so there are both a healthy and an unhealthy version of each. And we tend to be really naturally inclined to two of these. And we tend to be disinclined to one of them. And so you might ask the question, which one do you tend to be least likely to do? Which one or two do you tend to do more? And I'm not even suggesting that you do it all always in a healthy way. It might be that you're unhealthy. It's Bridget, it's not clear. It's not safe to say that sevens are always against. They're certainly not always against. Sevens are assertive, which is a kind of red, like, you know, moving out energy. Doesn't mean they're against, though. Often they can be quite avoidant of conflict. But they're also, most sevens aren't afraid of conflict. Most sevens have some ability to go, if I don't like it, I'm going to tell you about it. And that absolutely can happen for sevens. They're not quite as belligerent as eights.
Yeah, I love this, Shane. I'd probably put myself, the primary would be towards and a secondary would be against. So I'd probably be that, in that purple zone. And could you just, can you say again some of the healthy versions of against? What that
looks like? Yeah, a big one is just boundary setting and protecting people. So when you say, hey, you really can't speak to me that way, or you can't talk to that person that way, there's going to be consequence. So it's stepping in and stepping up and having a backbone and an ability to kind of move things out of the way, move obstacles out of the way. That's the healthy expression of against.
Okay. I guess maybe I think that way because in my profession, I definitely, in like being a one, that people pleaser part of me definitely feels like the towards is a primary. But in my profession, I have to be much more like no, we can't do that, and just say and have clear boundaries. Like no, we're staying on this lane. I feel like when I see the word away, I kind of sense it more like staying out of it, and I feel like I'm always engaged in it. Yes. So
Yes. So, and a big part of this model is to help us think about why don't I stay away? What is it about going away that I fear or that I don't like? What would happen if I went away? Bad things. What bad things would happen if I went away? And just starting to surface near the end of our trainings, I do a polarity mapping exercise that'll actually make use of this in a different way. That's super insightful. That reveals a lot. But it's good to have it right now in the front of your mind.
That's a good question. That's a great question.
Yes. Right. And what happens is when you learn to integrate away, you become increasingly balanced, right? So the reason what I always feared was I never wanted people not to like me. That's why I didn't move against, because someone might not like me as the three, right? The desire to be liked. I just wanted people to like me, and moving against the people that moved against me, I didn't like very much. So I didn't want to be one of those. And it wasn't until much later in life that I began to integrate it. And as I integrated it, I realized, oh, actually people at least respect you more. They may not like you, but they at least know where you stand and that it's true. And that's worth a lot to people. So that's my story, right? But you might look at yours, each of you. Anybody else want to comment on where they are? I saw Mindy, you're in the green territory. You have an awareness of what it is that prevents you from trying out red.
I'm a nine and I hate conflict. I'm afraid people won't like me, right?
Yeah.
I want peace. I want everybody to be happy, calm.
Yeah. Good awareness. Okay, one more and then we'll go to the next section here. Who else wants to share what color?
I think
I think I would probably put myself in the orange, in that I don't enjoy conflict. So I think I would more likely move away, but I'm assertive and can overcome obstacles and kind of, what was it? Boundaries. Like I can do it when I need to. So I think I probably go between those two. What would you say the towards characteristics are again, like the positive ones?
It's a combination of warmth, connection, reaching mm-hmm. out, compassion, nurture, but it can also be vulnerability. So the expression of need, the revelation of need, mm-hmm. Without being needy, that's a subtlety, but that often people that struggle with towards, they can be really good at it on one level. Like I'm really good at caring and nurturing for others, but I'm atrocious at receiving from others, which is fundamentally a towards gift. Yeah. And so often we might have, so for most of my life, I was expert at meeting everybody else's needs, Enneagram 2, my wing, but I was really, really bad at admitting I had my own needs. That mm-hmm. was always scary for me, which again, same driver, didn't fear people wouldn't like me.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cause at first I heard the warm and connection. And so at first I was like, oh, I'm totally a towards, but the more I sat and thought about it, I'm probably not.
Or you might have some aspect of it and another aspect lives more in the shadow.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right. Great awareness, everybody. Okay. Now we're going to go to the next little thing here. And this will be the last thing we'll cover. And then we'll open it up for questions. There's another thing that I noticed about people. And it's sort of like that, a way towards and against. But it uses different dimensions and it kind of generates different results. And that is, I noticed that there was this tendency for people to relate to others in both speed and directness. So there are some people that really want to talk now. And there are other people that really would rather talk later. They like to delay when they're going to have that conversation. Some people like to talk around things, and there are some people that tend to want to talk straight at things. And you can also map Enneagram types on this as well, typically. But those people that tend to want to talk now and talk straight, that category I call the general. And you can imagine all the ways that a general is incredibly useful. There are certain contexts in which, and by the way, these aren't really so much types as they are styles, right? So you can migrate, you can develop, you can move, you have a tendency, you may respect one and not like another, but you might really be good at a variety of them. But a general is really great when there's a lack of clarity in the organization, for example, then a general is great. Hey, we're going to get in this. We're going to talk now. We're going to talk straight. When there's crisis, often that can be really useful. When there's really, really delicate emotional implications, the general can be, you know, like a dictator and a tyrant and really, really problematic and disruptive. And so talking now and talking straight as a modality isn't always the best one. Then you've got talk later, talk straight. I call this the archer. That's that person that sits back and waits and listens and gathers information and listens and gathers information. And then they kind of surgically strike with a big straightforward idea that really creates clarity usually. Fives are often archers. They have the ability to kind of perceive and wait and then nail it. Sometimes nines can be quite archer-like. But the advantage here is that it's usually very, very clear-eyed thinking and it's usually very informed thinking. The danger is sometimes it can turn into like a lot of wasted time because the archer will often wait too long. So they miss the opportunity to like move the needle when they needed to. And sometimes the archer, depending on motives, can be like an assassin. They can really be quite strategic and then quite damaging depending on who and what they are and what their motives are. So that's kind of the shadow side. So each of these has a gift and a shadow. Then they have people who like to talk later and talk around. I call this the diplomat. The diplomat is extremely useful in high conflict situations where there are really, really strong competing views and opinions. Really useful when dealing with strongly opposing stakeholder views, and there needs to be some kind of harmony. They really seem to understand the need to just let the fruit ripen a little bit before you pick it. Like, it's okay to wait and let something unfold. And when you get into it, it's okay to kind of get smart about how you're going to talk about it. Now, the downside of the diplomatic course is that there isn't a lot of clarity. So if you are always bringing the diplomat to every single situation, you lose that opportunity for clarity. When they become the shadow side of the diplomat is the politician. You know, they just, you don't even know what they believe or where they stand. And so it starts to like, do I trust this person? What are they really doing here? Okay. And then you have those that like to talk now, but talk around. I call this the magician. There are people that are just really, really gifted at speaking, you know, quickly, but developing pretty elaborate reframes to help people imagine things in different ways. Often, like, motivational speakers tend to be this kind of magician type, or like the Tony Robbins of the world or whatever. They have this ability to like create new frames and imagine new things in these indirect ways to like get you to a place. And they do it relatively quickly. They're not waiting around. They're not doing a lot of listening. There's a lot of like, I already know the answer. Let me help you get there. And so that's the magician. Now, the downside of the magician, and this is awesome when you have like low morale and you're just needing to be lifted up, and or when there's a need to convince people, to influence people, to move in a new direction without being kind of a lightning rod. The magician is really great at that. But the magician can revert into like the used car salesman. You know, if they become a little bit manipulative and kind of use their skills and art forms, maybe not for good. And that's the magician. So there you go. There's the big four kind of categories that I noticed that I, when I work with people over the years. And then I added this fifth one. I just call it the conductor. The conductor is when we achieve that ability to know that we have access to all of these and we need to use all of them, but we understand the context in which they can be used, and we notice our shadow when we use them. So that's when you've arrived at a conductor-like state, when you're like, not only do I know my tendency, not only do I know my shadow, but I also have the skills and the abilities to execute that. And so the hard conversations training we're going to do next week really is designed to kind of help us notice this part of us and figure out how to be that conductor to have conversations in the right way. So I'll pause there for a minute. This is your chance to reflect and share out. What do you notice about yourself? Where do you map yourself? You might be three of these. You might be the conductor. You might be one of them. So for me, I definitely was the magician most of my life. That's where I lived. That's what I tended to do. It's what I tended to prefer. I could certainly dip into the diplomat pretty easily, but my natural default is I like to talk now. And I had a history of being a little bit indirect. Again, it's that the magician wants to be seen and noticed and liked, and that's what I was doing. So, and Bridget, I get your magician. Great. Who else?
I feel like if I'm put on the spot, then I'm a bit magician-y. But my natural tendency is the diplomat or the archer.
Yeah. Yep. That makes sense. That's consistent with the nine. You know, the nine lives under that talk later. Mm-hmm. and I think typically talk around.
I'm a shadowy archer. Like, I will wait.
Yes.
I will wait for karma to take you down.
That's the assassin. Yeah, that's when the archer becomes the assassin.
Mm-hmm. I'm that's my dark side.
I love your awareness. That's good. It's beautiful.
Shane, can I ask a clarification? When you say talk straight, I feel like I can relate to this one. I don't like to sugarcoat something. If I don't like something, I will say. If I love something, I'm like, I guess that's straight talker, which has gotten me into a lot of problems in corporate world, telling my boss, like, no, I'm not going to do that because that's not ethical. And then stepping down from my position because I was like, I can't do this anymore. But is that more of like our values that I have a strong like passion about it, I talk straight versus some stuff I'm just going to like, I don't really care, right? Because I can definitely say I need to talk now, talk around. So I'm definitely magician side, but I see a lot of the archer and the general part that's also in there. that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And it's a great question. So, you know, a lot of it's just personality, and sometimes it is your values, and your values are the thing that will drive and govern a lot of decisions. What I like to introduce to people is possibilities. So, for example, sometimes people will say, well, I've got to say it that way, and I need to do it now because it matters so much to me. I'm so convicted by it that I would never lay down on that. I'll fall on my sword over it. And what I always like to introduce is, well, that's one option. You have other possibilities, which is you can commit to your perspective and still keep your job, or you can commit to your perspective and still get promoted. And I'm not asking you to lie. I'm not asking you to lay down on your beliefs. I'm asking you to frame them in do different ways so that you can actually achieve what you're most after, which is usually higher than your first instinct, which is like, what I want is to not compromise my values. Got it. And you're like, yeah, great. That's your initial want. You might have a deeper want, which is you want to transform the organization and you believe you can. Well, good. Then that means you can't just go with your immediate instinct. That means there's a deeper desire and a new strategy that needs to be deployed in order for you to be really effective. So I learned this really hard when I was a pastor of a really big church. My boss was a woman named Betsy DeVos, who was our Secretary of Education. Not at the time I was working for her. She became that later under the Trump administration. She was born a billionaire, and she was bafflingly incompetent, like grossly incompetent in her role. And I make no comment about whether you liked her as the Secretary of Education or if you even knew that. I'm not commenting about that. I'm commenting about her in the role of being my boss at a church. She was terrible. And the reason I learned later she was terrible is because she had no accurate mirroring ever. She was a billionaire in a town of 190,000 people. She owned the town. So everybody was a sycophant. I came from outside the town, didn't realize that dynamic existed, and I refused to be a sycophant, and I was a general. And she hated me for it. And we did not get along. And as a result, she won. At the end of the day, I had to leave because I just got outmaneuvered and I didn't understand what was happening. So I had all these weird things going wrong, and it was all this white gloves technique. And years later, I learned from a very gifted coach. I tried to walk him through, like, I did this and that happened. And he's like, oh yeah, you were being punished. And I'm like, what? I'm not a child. I'm not a parent. No, you're being punished. I'm like, why am I being punished? He's like, oh, you invalidated her at some point. Probably said something in a meeting that invalidated her, and that was the end of it. I was like, well, that's bullshit. He's like, yeah, maybe, but that's what happened. You're living proof that it occurred. So what you have to learn to do is learn to hold some of your cards back. And I was like, oh, because I'd walk in and be like, here are all my cards. Now I'm assuming you guys are going to give me all your cards, and then we'll just sort it out, right? And they're like, oh, you just played all your cards. Okay, yeah, I'll play this one. And then these three I'm going to hold back, and that one. Yeah, Shane, we're good. And so that's what happens to people that tend to be generals. They tend to walk in and they walk through and they create all of their own obstacles and don't even realize they're creating their own obstacles. And then they feel like a victim, like, why they're the terrible, I'm the right. And so I had this righteous indignation, and I learned later that I really should have been a diplomat. If I had been a diplomat, I would have been successful in that context. I just didn't validate it. I hated it. I thought it was stupid and dishonest. And I later learned it's not dishonest. It's strategic and smart, and it supports a higher objective. I don't know. Does that answer your question, Christine, or is that?
Yeah, big time, because everything, I was like, yes, that's exactly what I felt. That's exactly, but it just didn't make sense to me at that point, because my boss, my director, she was that drill. Like, this is the only way we do stuff. It's like a yes or no. Like, you know, it's like, if I tell you to jump, you're going to ask me how high, right? But I was like, no, but why do I have to jump? Like, why can't we do it this way? Like, I want to change the world. I want to change our department. Like, I want all this stuff. And I would speak up. I don't keep my mouth shut. Like, I was like, no. And I didn't understand what you were just explaining. But again, that cost me of not being in the right environment to thrive and grow. Because I was not in the right container, which was one of the best thing that happened to me. I was like, peace out, I'm out. I'm creating my own legacy now. So yeah.
Yeah. And and that's great. That's right. Like, I shouldn't have been in the church long term either. That was good. However, I could have left on different terms and in a different way had I been smarter. And I could have left in a way that wasn't so disruptive to people. I was disrupting. I was in there disrupting things not for a purpose other than my own commitment to my own perspective, which was very myopic, and it lacked sufficient complexity for the level of complexity I was leading in. And that's what I would say for most leaders is, I hear this all the time from leaders, like, I'm just a person who speaks my mind. They always wear that with a badge of pride. Like, oh, that's the best way to be. And I'm that way. And they're like, yeah, that's great. That's awesome. If you like to set fire to things, sometimes you're right. You can be incendiary and burn things to the ground and not know that you've burned them to the ground and blame everybody else for it. And so that's the art of human development, is that that's moving from that I'm not aware to I am aware, that says you have the ability to not have to always speak straight. You have the ability to wait in order to speak. And when you learn the power in that and validate that, now you can actually deploy a whole lot of chess pieces on the board. For me, I was playing a chess match that were like checkers. You know, they were all playing chess. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to use my one pawn and just keep moving them around. They're like, yeah, you're done, man. You have no ability to navigate this. And that would be true even if you're forging your own path in the world. You know, you're going to deal with complex systems that don't like what you're doing, that don't validate you, and you're going to have to learn how to navigate those. And that's one of the trainings I do later in the course, is how do you speak to people who have more power than you? That's, I learned that all the hard way. And so that's in module of bonus 5, how to manage up and across. But I actually do it on the calls as well. Awesome. Okay. Who else wants to say a word or two about where they live here on this? Yes.
I love this, Shane. This is great. I love the reference of them being styles, and that we have access to all of them, and that we don't have to just, you know, just say, okay, this is what I am always. It's like, well, I got to be this at certain points, and this is other points and other relationships that I have. I tend to, for me, I kind of just again thinking from the one got to be right. There's a right way to do things. There's that I kind of go like counterclockwise, starting at the general and then going to the magician, diplomat, archer, and just kind of saying, okay, that's kind of my natural bent. And I like to live mostly at the magician if I can. But sometimes I got to make these decisions here. But if I picture that in my mind, okay, this counterclockwise is kind of like my natural flow. Like, I mean, archer is something I don't get to very often, but there's times where I have to do that and just go, okay, just be patient and wait. But if I know that about me, be self-aware, I go, okay, it's hard for me to wait. I'm gonna have to practice that patience and get that discipline to be able to get my ducks in a row before I make that decision or make that point. And it could be very wise to be an archer in certain contexts. So yeah, again, just the idea that all of them are accessible and kind of seeing for my own self a flow from counterclockwise from one to the others.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Great stuff. Great stuff. Good. All right. And Dorothy, I saw you said magician and then sometimes general when you get frustrated, which is actually very two-like. That's a fairly classic two. So that's good. Good awareness. Okay, cool. Well, that's all we're going to do for today on the presenting teaching side. So now open it up for comments, questions, coaching needs, whatever's going on in your lives, whatever you need. What's up? Yes, Dorothy.
Awesome. I had a hard conversation go wrong on Monday.
All right.
So I'll give you as brief a context as possible. This was with Rohan, our senior media buyer, was frustrated in kind of two areas. One, you know, there's been mounting frustration over the last 6 months or so of feeling like he's kind of operating like a junior media buyer rather than a senior media buyer, which I think is really kind of a question of like skill and like ability to do that. But then on the kind of operational communication side, just a lot of frustrating things there. And kind of the straw that broke the camel's back was he was just on a 3-week trip. And, you know, we took everything off of his plate for those 3 weeks, except for, you know, one small reporting task. And he ended up missing, you know, several days of that And, you know, without communicating. And then Monday was his first day back after these 3 weeks, you know, off, and he missed the, you know, morning team call because he slept through his alarm. So it was kind of just the straw that broke the camel's back on a lot of frustration. And, you know, Lisa had a conversation with him where, you know, he basically said, you know, oh, this was kind of one-off circumstances, you know, hopefully you'll see like my performance speaks for itself. And so I felt like he didn't really understand kind of the gravity of how, you know, how much frustration had kind of built. So then I had a conversation with him and, you know, I think my intention for the call was to, you know, one, kind of make clear how kind of serious these issues are. And then to, you know, really kind of, you know, like make sure he knows he needs to step up, but that also, you know, we want to kind of provide him with the development opportunities to do that. And, you know, I think instead of leaving him kind of eager to, you know, step up and, you know, really kind of learn and grow and develop, I think I ultimately left him like demoralized and, you know, demoralized and frustrated and, you know, yeah. So I think I have a pattern, frankly, of like letting frustration build until it kind of explodes in a conversation. And then, you know, I don't get the result that, you know, I'm hoping for.
Yeah. I so appreciate that and have been in that situation. And so I think we can all relate to your frustration of when somebody just isn't showing up the way you know you need them to, and you've made it clear and they're just not. So first of all, acknowledge that and celebrate the joys of being a leader and a manager. The second thing I'll say is your sense that that's a conversation that needs to be have a do-over, or do you feel like it just needs to just live and be done?
So he ended up, you know, basically asking this morning if he could like complete his couple tasks and then sign off for the day. He said that, you know, he's been going over the conversation in his head and processing things for himself and that he has thoughts and maybe when they're fully formed, he'll share. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think there's definitely going to obviously be another conversation.
So is there anything about that conversation that you already know that you would have done differently?
Yes, I feel good about how I handled like the piece about kind of like the operational issues and communication, you know, making clear that like, you know, that was unacceptable and there is kind of a pattern of that type of thing. I think where I really went wrong was, you know, on the side of like, you know, you're kind of operating at the level of a junior media buyer. We need you to be operating at the level of a senior media buyer. You know, I think he was confused by that because I think he felt like he'd been doing a really great job. And, you know, in fairness, you know, it really was kind of him taking these 3 weeks off and John kind of managing all of his accounts that made us realize, you know, all right, there's a lot of, you know, ways that he, you know, is not operating at the level that he needs to be operating at. But I think I probably was way too hard on him, you know, in that area. And I think he probably felt like that it was very kind of out of the blue and he probably felt, I can see how he would have felt very like attacked. But that's because it was, you know, for me, it's been 6 months of this building feeling. And I think I just kind of exploded all of that buildup on him in a conversation in a way that was not fair to him, honestly.
Great. Okay, good. Well, love all of that. Good to know it. And that's the kind of stuff that you bring to a follow-up conversation is, hey, I think there was missing context that if I were in your shoes, this is a great phrase you should memorize and use a lot. If I were in your shoes, if I were in your shoes, I might feel X. It's just a really easy way to signal that you're thinking about not just you, but them. So if I were in your shoes, I might feel really blindsided, but you're not saying this is how you feel. You're just kind of taking, so that is a helpful way in to go, hey, if I were in your shoes, I probably would have felt a little blindsided. And I own that. I think that I have failed to do a good job of letting you know what's been building up in me. And that's on me. And I need to do a better job of staying present with you to the impact you're having on me in the business. And second thing is, you know, I think there's another missing piece of information that we didn't give you, we should have, and we should have started there, which is, hey, when you took 3 weeks off and we started looking through your account, we saw a whole lot of opportunities and gaps. And we didn't just sit down with you and say, hey, when you were gone, we noticed a lot of gaps and we want to work with you to close the gaps. You know, that's a little bit more specific. The other thing I would just say is, this is the hard part about hard conversations too, is anytime you locate somebody by demoting them in their behavior and they feel then geolocated somewhere else, it's a lot more disorienting and disruptive emotionally than if you just talk about the behavior and their impact. So if you were to just remove the whole junior, senior, medium, just say, here's our expectation of performance. Here's what we're noticing the performance is. Here's the gap. And then you don't have to create a meaning layered on top of that. That's where people take the feedback and tell stories. And in particular, they become quite defensive. You know, so their defensiveness rises and then they can't hear you anyway. So the most powerful and effective way to actually be heard is to just start with a flag for them and for you. Like, it's okay if you've waited 6 months, you would start the conversation there and say, hey, I'm going to come to this conversation with a lot more energy than is warranted, but I can't lie to you. I got a lot of energy right now. And that energy is connected to a failure on my part. I really owed you this feedback a while ago and I just never did it. And that's on me. So I just want you to hear that first. Second, I'm really frustrated because I feel like we've been clear about what we need and I haven't been getting the performance. Third, once you left for those 3 weeks, John was able to review your accounts and we noticed there's some pretty big gaps, or whatever, doesn't have to be big, but there are gaps that we have to close, that we just need to get better alignment around. So that's another way to have had that conversation if you were to go back and redo it. And I think you can do a version of that, which just says, first, an apology and an ownership. I let it build. I shouldn't have. That's on me. Second, this. Third, this. The other thing that you can do sometimes is you can say, hey, this is where you put it on them as someone who has to perform, they're not performing. Let's say you've asked them to do a task 10 times or 5 times or 3 times, and they're just not doing it. You just simply say, can you help me out? I'm really confused. I'd love your guidance on this. I told you this, I asked you this, I asked you this. All three times it didn't happen. Can you help me understand what I'm not doing well to help you understand that that needs to happen? And then it's a way of forcing them to reflect on, it's a weird technique, but it's basically saying, I haven't been an effective manager because I'm not getting what I need from you. Can you tell me what I need to do in order to get what I need from you?
Correct.
And it's a jujitsu move, because what it really does is it invites the opposite of defensiveness. Okay. So they may even say, yeah, you're not clear in your direction. Okay, great. What would help me? What would help you for me to be more clear? Should I write it down? What would help me be more clear? Give me concrete suggestions. Like, clarity is great, but I need concrete suggestions. What'll happen is they'll go, you know, as they're coaching you, they're automatically going, where did I fall down? Yeah. And they're now invited into the, you know, it wasn't just you. I realized that I haven't done a good job of setting a reminder and I keep forgetting. Okay, great. What are we going to do to make sure you don't forget? Like, should we set the reminders right now? Can we do that together? Because this is affecting me a lot. And I know you don't want to affect me this much. So those are the kinds of, does that help at all?
It does. Absolutely. Yeah. I wish I could take back that call, but
This is really good. Dorothy, don't feel bad about this at all. This is really important for everybody to hear. Conversations in the workplace are very high stakes, but they're also like clay. They're not like concrete. So if you screw up once, it's never just set in stone. There's always an opportunity. Human beings are very capable of adapting, adjusting, and correcting. And you're just giving it that opportunity. And so, you know, the follow-up conversation, I wouldn't wait for him. I would initiate it. And I would say, hey, you may not be ready to have this conversation, but I have some things that I owe you. And the first thing I owe you is an apology for X, Y, and Z. Second thing I owe you is better clarity and a little more context that you didn't have. And then I want to hear from you. What do you want to say to me that you think I don't understand or didn't see or didn't appreciate? Is there anything that I don't get that you wish I did as a manager of a business? That's another great question to ask people when they're not performing, is to ask, it's kind of that what could I do to be a better manager? But you do it in a little bit more targeted way, which is, what do you wish I understood that maybe you think I don't?
I think another element of this, which I think I need to just be forthcoming about, is, I have hesitations, in his ability to get where we need him to be. And, I don't know that he's the right fit for the team. I think that's kind of another layer of this where, it kind of complicates like how I handle this a little bit, because we're kind of in this place now where it's like, we have two roads we can go down. In order to get him where he needs to be, it requires John to invest a lot of time in his development. And I don't know that I feel good in using John's time in that way when there's also kind of these other issues.
Great question. So there are a couple of ways to handle that. I mean, you didn't say a question, but I interpret it as a question. There are a couple of ways to handle this. One is you give him the map and the everything about it, and you say, we got about 90 days. So this is a 90-day performance plan conversation, which is basically like, hey, this is where you are. This is where we need you to be. We got about a 90-day window to get you there. And we don't have the resources to deploy to get you there from where I sit. That doesn't mean we don't want you to have that opportunity. We want you to get there. And so if you can find a way to get there and demonstrate it, we're good. Then I want you to win. I want you to be successful. But I owe it to you to be really clear about what is needed and what's expected. And this is that moving against thing, but from a posture of clarity. So, just a reminder to everybody, when they've rank ordered bosses, the bosses that are ranked the highest are those that are really truthful and direct and respectful. The bosses that are ranked next highest are assholes. And the bosses that are ranked the worst are the nice bosses. And it's really interesting because with assholes, and that's a technical term, technical leadership development term, with assholes, you know where you stand. And even if you were disrespectful, or you at least I know what they think of me. Whereas nice bosses, there's a lot of like, is that really what's going on? I don't even know where I stand. I don't know what's really happening. And so when a nice boss is nice for a long time, all of a sudden they go, wait, you're terrible. I got to get you out of here. They're like, what? I didn't know I was terrible. How long have you felt I was terrible for? So I'm not saying that's what you are. I'm just encouraging all of you that letting people know where they stand is one of the best things you can do. And not hiding that from them and just saying, yeah, there's a big enough gap here that we need you to close it. And we don't just need you to close it eventually. We need you to close it within 90 days. So let's you and I meet regularly, or however structure you want to create, meet regularly until you meet that. And we'll just stay on track. I assume these are fairly objective metrics or things you can observe. Is that fair to say? Or is it pure art?
I honestly think it's kind of more on the art side, because it's obviously there's KPIs in every account, but it's really that, we need him to not just be like taking John's ideas and implementing them. We need him to be like coming up with his own ideas and, being creative and, displaying a higher level of strategic thinking, which is a little more like harder to define.
So I do think that it's worth you just maybe convening with Lisa and John and asking the question, okay, I think we're at a 90-day performance plan. Do we want to deploy any resources to helping him? Have we decided that he's not capable? And then you're having the how to have a termination conversation, which is also in the Module 3, one of the last videos, which I highly recommend you watch. You should start. There's a whole process that you institute that'll make that conversation a whole lot easier.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Shane. This has been really helpful. Yeah,
you bet. Okay. Who else wants to share, talk, ask questions? Davia, I think this is one of your last, you have another call after this, second to last call, correct? I don't know if you're still there.
Yes, I'm still here. I think so, but I don't remember us having the, going through five, where the, how to manage up and across.
Yeah, let me just.
From that one.
Let me see where that usually is. And it's possible that I don't do it on here. Let me just see here. All right. You know what? I don't have it in the list of things. It's in the bonus. It's one of the bonuses. Okay. If you want, I can do it next week. I typically don't get on these calls because sometimes I just have business owners and sometimes I have managers. And so business owners often don't have a boss, so they're less interested in that training. But it's actually still valid, even if you don't have a boss. Like, you have clients and you have stakeholders and you have people that you don't have power over that you need things from. And so it can be a useful training. So maybe it's something I should do.
Okay.
Is that something you're wanting to talk about?
Actually, yes, because normally Jessica, I think she's in here, and then Debbie's in here with me. I think it will really help take some of the managing off my plate, like these crucial conversations. I think it's really great for them to hear, so I don't have to be the bad guy all the time.
Yeah. So. Well, here's what I'm going to suggest. I think what we should do is you guys should watch the bonus five, which is, it'll go deeper than I can even on a call. And there's a guidebook and a workbook, and just consume that content. And then when we get on the call next week, just we can talk about it generally. Awesome. So that sounds good.
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you.
Awesome. And Davia, we had at one time talked, I'm very happy to have a one-to-one call with you. You know, maybe just a private coaching call after you're done. Be glad to do that with you.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, cool. We'll get that on the calendar soon, okay?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Usually I'm a lot more vocal, guys. It's just I'm not feeling too great today, so.
Well, I'm so sorry. Are you not feeling good, like physically sick or more emotional?
It's just when I think it's physical, you know, when you start to feel bad. So.
Yes, I'm aware. Okay, good. Well, we hope you feel better. Thank you for joining, nonetheless.
Thank you.
Good. Who else has something they want to talk about?
I just want to add that everything Dorothy shared, that's exactly where I've been feeling. I had a contractor that I upgraded one services to add more because she did a great job pitching me to, hey, let's do more. Someone who does, you know, website, you know, that's what I hired her for, email sequences, launches, and all that, was like, hey, I also do marketing. We're going to take this whole brand to the whole new level. So I like double the salary, and I yet to have one social media post or email newsletter to go out that has nothing to do with my launch. Or so I'm like, I've been paying like all this money for the last 3 months, and I hate conflict. I'm like, it's okay, like it's on me because I should be on top of it. I'm not, you know, like I should be the boss that I am and be on top of that. Hey, why is this not being delivered? Hey, this is what you said we're gonna do and it's not being met. So I literally just send an email saying, like, you know, I would love to request a meeting for a 90-day review of what we've been talking about before we move forward for the March, so then we're all in the same place. So I think I'm like hearing Dorothy like talking before like realizing, I was like, okay, good. This, I needed to hear this because now I'm more prepared to go to the call versus just like boiled and like, you just suck. And I don't want that to happen because I love working with her. It just like that services is not what I saw she can deliver. But again, I was just excited. But I know it's a lot on us too as leaders to recognize, like, you know, we are business owners and relationship and personal, you know, vibe does not, like, it has to be separate. So I can still love you, be friends with you, but if I'm hiring you for this services, I better get that shit. Like, it, so that's going to be a interesting conversation to have, because I see how my time is being sacrificed because she has other commitments for other coaches she does work with. And I'm like, but I also have a big lunch that's coming up tomorrow, but you were gone to serve another client. I'm like, how's this fair? And my work is not done. So I'm like, I need to also speak up too. Anyways, I'm more of like expressing everything that's been building up because I just don't like to be that bad person and be like, hey, how about me? Like, I'm paying you for the services. I have a big lunch coming up. I shouldn't be stressing out about like your travel schedule, your availability, and what you can deliver, you know? So
That's great. I'm so glad the conversation helps you. One thing I just want to flag for you, you mentioned, business and personal are separate. I actually believe that when you have a friendship and you work with someone, it is impossible to separate the two. It doesn't mean you shouldn't work with people that you're friends with. It means that those people that fail to understand that your personal relationship can be harmed by the way you do business together. Like the stakes only go up when you are personally friends with somebody. And what I always encourage people to do, if you are working with a friend, is you say to them, this friendship matters a lot to me, and how we work together could harm our relationship, our friendship. If we aren't honest and direct and clear, if I'm holding things back and not telling you the truth, if you're holding things back and not telling me what's going on, our friendship could get hurt. And I really don't want it to be. And so our agreement with each other needs to be that if I'm frustrated or something's not working right, it is my responsibility to bring that to you immediately. And the same is back for you. And then we got to work together. As long as you're open and transparent and direct, you can save almost any friendship, even if it means termination. You just have to do it well. And so what usually happens in a close personal relationship and a work relationship is you actually do the opposite, which is you become less honest and less clear and less direct. And so I always encourage people when you hire or start working with a close friend, as you just say right up front, much more is expected of you and I than anybody else I work with because I'm your friend and I want to keep being your friend. But our friendship could be at risk. And I can't tell you how many friendships have been lost over bad working agreements and just not being direct, not being honest. And then people feel betrayed.
Yeah. And I think mine, in my scenario, Shane, it's actually the opposite. These are complete strangers that I get to meet at events and relation, and I start building the relationship, hire them. And now our contract relationship is becoming more friendship. So it's more of like going from being a complete stranger, working together. And I'm very like, I'm all about relationship building. So I go deep. And I feel like I also need to have like some sort of like a boundaries as well too, a little bit. I'm like very like open book and everything like that. But I think just having that conversation from the beginning, especially when it becomes like too friendly versus I work for you friendly. So, because that's what's, that's tough.
Yep.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. I needed to hear this. Dorothy, good luck, my love.
Yeah.
You got this.
Yeah. Let me know next week how it goes. If you have it this week, I don't know if you will, but if you do, let me know. And Dorothy, if you want to reach out anytime between now and next week, just let me know.
You're the best, Shane. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Who else? What else do you guys want to talk about? What else is going on? Yes.
I have a hard conversation that I'm supposed to do. And it's a tough one for me. So I manage managers, and I have an account manager on my team that is in charge of a team in a building, right? She has been with the company for years. She came up kind of through the ranks. So she has a really deep understanding of the business. The challenge, and she's been very loyal to the business, like has very high ideals. I think she's a six. So she's there. She expects a lot of herself, but she also expects a lot of other people. And our company has changed very dramatically in the last 2 years. So we have a lot of new people coming in that are not meeting her expectations. And she has a tendency, she's kind of a general. She tends to be very honest and very, she calls people out. She has a habit of doing this in meetings with kind of her leadership peer groups. And it's, I'm starting to get feedback on how can you let her say that? How can you let her behave that way? And I understand their point, right? It is a bit, you know, she's a bit, she comes off as it's like, I don't trust you, right? I'm going to keep my, I am right, you are wrong. And I'm just going to let you, right? I'm not going to have any of it, right? So she's not, you know, as a leader, kind of displaying empathy or understanding or being solution oriented, right? Now, on the other hand, I always appreciate her view, and I appreciate her speaking up because she will tell it like it is, and not everybody else does. She also sees things that are happening that other people don't. They just kind of, you know, they won't address it. So I'm trying to balance, like, how do I have this coaching conversation with her to get her to the point of leadership that I think not only benefits the team, but would benefit her.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of different ways to do this. And I'll give you one way that, because what you described is, so if I understand this right, this is somebody who reports to you, mm-hmm. and you're getting feedback from people who report to her, correct?
No, I'm getting feedback from peer group, right? Other leaders that are at her same level, either that are reporting to me or my peers that have experienced her in meetings.
Okay. But she is your direct report.
Correct.
You manage her. Okay. So that's different. I was going to suggest, just in case this ever happens to any of you, I'll give you one version and then maybe we'll do a different version for you. The first version is actually, if you're getting level skipping and people are coming to you about this person's no good, and you're like, how do I have this conversation? Because what you then do is you reveal that people below them have been talking about them behind their back. And that can become really problematic. You can get punished for doing that, right? Even if it's unconscious. So what I always do is I make it an overt process. So I'll say to somebody, hey, either I make it super proactive and I just say, hey, I'm going through a process with each of my leaders. I'm picking to start with you. This is what the process is going to be. I want you to send an email to all your direct reports and a couple of key people you work with. And the email will look like this, and I'm going to paste it in the chat. So there's the email. I mean, you'll edit this for content, but this is the basic idea. What you're doing is you're involving them in soliciting feedback from the people they work with. And what you're going to do is you're going to say, I'm just going to, after you send that email, I'm going to go out and talk to a few of the people. I'm just going to go ask them for input about how they're working with you and what it's like. And so that's thanks, Dorothy. Have a good one. So that's a way that you get them to be less defensive already, because they've agreed to a process that says, I want you to talk to my boss about how you experience me because I want to be a better leader. So it takes away any of the shame and humiliation of people talking bad about you behind your back. It gives them the power to say, yep. And you're going to do it to say, hey, this is something I'm doing with others. That's one way to do it, right? So it avoids the direct confrontation. You're doing a bad job. It's also valid. I mean, that's a low anxiety way of doing it, because what'll happen is you now have permission, because she sent the permission, to come back to her and say, hey, I talked to people. This is what we're learning. This is the feedback. They really like this about you. You're awesome at this. We love that. Some people are noticing this. Some people are feeling this about you. So that's how you can give that feedback in a way that they're going to receive it. Another way you do it is you say, hey, there's a bunch of static in the system and I need to figure out what's noise and what's signal. And so I want to run a process because I want to be fair to you. So now you're flagging for them that something isn't quite right. So it's a valid way to do it too. It's more direct. So you just have to decide, you know, some people are more sensitive and more affected by that. Some people aren't. So you want to decide. So that's one way that you can use. It's especially effective when you're dealing with level skipping, when it's people below her that shouldn't be talking to you, but you're getting the feedback anyway. That's how you clear that up and clean it up. In your case, you're not getting a lot of level skipping, so you don't have to do this, but it can be useful. So if you didn't want to do this, then I think the conversation is pretty straightforward. It's, hey, I need to talk to you about, I'm getting some static in the system. There's static, and I want to talk to you so that I can try to figure out what's noise and what's signal. You know, and that metaphor is simply, there's a lot of information. I'm not taking any of the information as gospel until I have a conversation with you. So let me just start with you. How are you feeling about your leadership? How are you feeling about how you're showing up? What's your frustration? What's going on for you? And let them talk. And if they're like, and if they talk, and then at the end, they don't share anything about the stuff you've heard, you go, okay, hey, so here's what I'm actually hearing. And then you start to talk through the feedback. Now, the most important thing when you're giving feedback is you focus on the behavior or the words and the impact they have. And you focus on those things that are repeated over time. So if it's a one-off complaint, not always that useful. If you've worked with them for years and they had a bad day, they had a bad day. It happens sometimes. We're humans. But if they've got a pattern of behavior that's consistent and repeated, and it's having a negative effect, you have to figure out what's the behavior, whether it's a word or a tone of voice or an action, and what's the impact. The impact could be on them without them knowing it, like it's eroding credibility. The impact could be on others, like it's causing people to be less collaborative with you. Or it could be an impact on you, the person who's managing them. It's making it difficult for me to advocate for you. I'm just making things up, right? But that's the exercise, is for you to figure out. And that would be true whether you did this process or just went straight at her. The reason that I like this other process is that it plays well to your preference to not have to go direct at someone. It effectively invites them into the process of, I'm going to get feedback from you now. You have thoughts on that?
No, I like having frameworks, right? So I like both options, right? I see how option A could be valuable for the whole entire team, honestly, as well as myself. And, but I, you know, the going at it directly, I think it's, you know, what are the behaviors? What's the impact that it's having? And because I would be interested too to hear her take on the question of how do you feel like you're doing in your role and your leadership?
And you can just say, hey, is there anything that's frustrating you lately? What's been frustrating you most? And so you just start with, hey, I'm getting some noise in the system. I feel like people aren't seeing eye to eye on things. I don't want to draw any conclusions until I talk to people. I want to start with you. Tell me how you're doing. Is there anything frustrating you? Anything that you're thinking about? I'd love to hear. And then if they go, oh, just this, this, and this, you're like, okay, well, what I'm hearing is this is an issue. And then you got to watch these behaviors having this effect on you.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing she tends to do is create these personal vendettas against individuals. Like, you know, an entire team is making mistakes and all it takes is one person kind of wronging her or a couple of times, and then she has no tolerance. They are like,
yeah, good. Dead. So in that case, if you need to confront something like that, you would avoid the phrase personal vendettas, because here it's fine. Of course, I'm just using it like workshopping it a little bit. Like, you have to reverse engineer what is a personal vendetta. What is the behavior that makes you conclude that it's a personal vendetta? So one behavior might be you target and invalidate. So some people have noticed that when a team isn't doing well, your language pattern targets the leader and invalidates them. And that erodes your credibility. So what I've done is I've identified a behavior. It's very concrete. I've said it's your language pattern. The words you use indicate you're targeting and invalidating, which is another way of personal vendetta, right? But you're effectively, when I say it that way, I'm walking around the defense the defense wall that's there. And you're just saying directly, these language patterns, whether you mean to or not, these language patterns are having this effect. That way they can't be like, no, I'm not targeting anybody. You're like, I'm not saying you're targeting them. I'm telling your language pattern indicates targeting and invalidating. So you're always trying to find the thing that is as close to factual as possible so that they can't debate it. Like, yeah, but that's, I don't do that. Okay, that certainly isn't your intent, but it is your impact. And that's where you, the more you can separate intent from impact, the less they can defend and argue, and the more they have to contend with reality.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's a good point, because I understand her intent. So, but there's a perception problem, because not everyone sees through my lens.
Yeah, which is great. And you can be an advocate, and you can say, my interest in this conversation is to be your advocate, but currently the behavior pattern is making that difficult. I would love your help in me being able to advocate for you. And this will help me. If you can address these things, it'll help me advocate even more. So that there's another example of the impact, right? So the impact is on you in this case and her. It's causing people to be less collaborative with you. It's making it difficult for me to advocate for you. That's two impacts, right? It's eroding your credibility because people read you in a way you don't intend.
Good stuff. Just making notes.
Yeah.
No,
that's all right, everybody. Well done. Great questions. Thanks for joining. Any other last things? We're a little over time, but that's okay. I was a few minutes late. Any last questions?
I love these sound bites.
Which sound bites?
Like just when you say the last one you said, my interest in this situation is to be your advocate. So just having those real simple, concise, not a lot of words to it, but really getting that point across. Like, I love a lot of the sound bites you shared today.
Good. If you look at module, I believe it's 3, there is a training called Switches. And there's a little PDF download of like 12 of the most common phrases leaders want to say and what to say instead.
Okay.
And it's literally just little language packets, just like you did. You know, I gave a few today. They're not in that training, but it's like, if I were in your shoes, I would want to know this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to, my interest in this conversation is, and a positive statement. Those are little language, but there's a whole bunch of them that are like, instead of you're not listening to me, it's I'm not being clear. Let me try again.
Oh, I love it.
That little phrase right there changes the whole equation.
Yeah.
It's no longer you, it's now me. And it signals for them that they're also not doing a very good job without doing it. So a huge part of the reason the general can always be dangerous is that it activates an immune response. And so that's why the diplomat, so these language packets, these switches that I call them, they're literally what a diplomat would do. It's sort of what I want to say is, don't interrupt me. What I need to say is it okay if I complete my thought? Mm-hmm. So it goes from command to permission. Mm-hmm. That is a very indirect way of speaking, but it's very succinct. It still makes the same message, but it's highly respectful. It's especially important when you do it in front of others. Mm-hmm. So module 3, you can download that. There's a bunch of little, you can memorize those things. Anytime you feel this, say that instead.
Will do.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Great to
be with you.
Thank you.
Bye.